This is John Costa with Rob Watson for the Spotlight on Art podcast. Rob, how are you this week?
I'm very well, thank you.
Cool. Weather still with us?
It's still grand out there.
Still grand.
Baking the flags.
We had a power cut last night up in the south.
Right.
For an hour and a half.
And did that turn off your air conditioning and your fans and your...
Well, jacuzzi, you know, outdoor Whirlpool,
washing machine all running at the same time. I'm solar powered.
How am I going to inflate my paddling pool? You know, all the usual stuff. Yeah, but it was about 10:15 to half past 11. So just perfect timing for like getting ready for... No light for making me notes last night. So
somebody was staying next door to us, was hanging out the window moaning about how warm it was. With a northern accent, so it must have been warm for him. So
down south, yeah. Right, so here on the Spotlight and Art podcast this week, we've got a very special guest, long-term friend of mine. I'm allowed to call him that, even though he's close enough to hit me if I've upset him. Is Jason Boomer. Jason, how are you?
Hi, yeah, I'm roasting.
Roasting, yeah, you're good. Yeah, heat-related, that's good. I like that, heat-related. Now, I'm going to start with getting you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how we know each other through sort of gaming and game development and stuff.
God, we've known each other for 10, 15 years at this point, I think it is.
Correct.
Yeah, you were the, it was you and Tina were the first people in Leicester to show us some kind of support for running games-based activities in Leicester, and the first people to help us get any funding.
Really?
Yeah, it was through the O2 Think Big.
Oh, God, back way, in the day with Somewhere Too and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think our first funding was £300, and we used it to hire a venue to run a gaming event that was raising funds for the charity Special Effect that produces kind of hardware to help people with physical disabilities get back into games. So, yeah, through the support that early on kind of helped us establish a gaming event called Rooster Teeth UK here in Leicester. And yeah, it ran for about 18 years in its totality. But when we kind of moved it from Nottingham to Leicester, you were the people that helped us get founded here.
Thank you for mentioning that. I feel incredibly humbled that you would even bother to remember that. But so I think it just shows you actually the good work that you were doing at the time that we would even, you know, consider trying to do something which was probably away from the norm of what other people were doing. And I think but here you are now, you know, not only are you studying it, but you're also doing it as a career as well. So just tell us a little bit about that journey. Where are you at now with the development of things?
So yeah, it's been a long meandering decade and a half, and you know, we started out as an events company, you know, running these gaming events. When we came back to Leicester, like I said, you helped us find our feet and kind of set us on this path. And you know, over the years, we've set up events like CreatorCon, which are, you know, free family STEM events that happen originally at DMU, but now over the LCV depot, and we're looking to grow from there.
And STEM is science, technology, engineering, and maths. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And more recently, we've expanded that to STEAM, or what I call creative technologies, because it's, you know, creativity involves, you know, science, technology, and all those things are themselves creative. So we like the idea of playable technologies and digital art. Is those two halves of the same coin are what define the work that we do, really, is running events that introduce people to these, you know, creative technologies, whether it's, you know, games or 3D printing, virtual reality, even things like Lego have that sort of creative and playable dimension to them. So that's what CreatorCon kind of embodies. It's this collection of people from across Leicestershire that run activities to do with all of those different things. And we bring them together every year in LCB Depot, and give away free tickets to it, and just kind of, you know, give people the opportunity to get into these different things as a way of kind of inspiring them to find a new hobby or pursue a new career or kind of, you know, connect with their education. And from there, well, we had to stop doing it because of the pandemic. We had, you know, 500 odd people in the same room, you know, touching all these different exhibitions and things like that doesn't really work with the pandemic. But over the period of the pandemic, we moved to delivering workshops online, and they were really popular. And when we came out the other side of the pandemic, we started delivering them in schools. So that's kind of where we are now, is we're more about educating people, young people specifically, to do with making their first video games.
So Jason, just you know, now there seems to be more events that are around, so, you know, cosplay and things like that, and then there's, like, you know, Lego build events and all that sort of stuff, and it's great that you go, but I always look at these things when I was thinking about, you know, some of the things that we've done with you in the past, you know, supporting CreatorCon and having tables and bits and pieces and reporting on it as Citizen's Eye back in the day, is the fact that these are still very much around people coming, participating, but there's a consumer element, which is about buying things and stuff like that, whereas you were always, and if you said it again there, you're always about inclusivity and people being able to have a go and find something new, or if you've already got a love of something, come along and just try something different and stuff. It's really important to you, isn't it, that educational element with a small e that people get out of it?
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with fan conventions and all that sort of thing, like the popular culture conventions, you know, most commonly like comic cons and things like this. They're great, but they serve a very particular purpose. You know, it's about kind of bringing people together around shared passion, where they can meet other people, show off their creativity, like through cosplay and things like this. But there is that commercial element to it. But for me, I like highlighting what's already happening in the area. So we're not bringing vendors into the city to then sell people things and then they leave. I'm really interested in finding people that are already here doing things, bringing them together, and then giving people access to that. So it's more of a signposting what's happening around the place. And if some attendee of one of these events finds something that really resonates with them, then they know it's here, they know it's local, they know they can get involved throughout the rest of the year, where you can't do that with things like Comic Cons because the vendors aren't here.
Yeah, they're like traveling things.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the fact that you're almost describing this gaming, interested in those kind of, you know, creative industry sector type things, almost like an ecosystem. Is that important to you as well, that about, you know, because the conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, you was like Leicester and Leicestershire, and it's creating this ecosystem here, and of course that would actually help retain people from any of the universities that are interested in this, because there's an ecosystem that they can participate in growing and actually helping to nurture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's what we've got 3 major universities in the county, Leicester, Loughborough and DMU, and dozens of schools, you know, a few colleges, all of them offer something that is games adjacent or fits into, you know, if you wanted to make games, you'll learn something there that will help you. But there isn't really much of an industry here. So what we try to do is to build that ecosystem. And as much as we'd like, you know, talking to the council, talking to funders, it's difficult. They're not going to just give us a large pot of money to set this thing up. So we're taking the grassroots approach. And that involves going out into the county, going into the schools, talking to parents, running these public events that allow us to build that groundswell of interest, so we can point them towards resources and opportunities in the city and in the county in order to kind of continue making games, learning about what it means to be in the games industry, or educating people about why games aren't always bad. I mean, games are good. Games are educational in the small e sense. They change you. You learn. You experience new cultures. You develop a skill. You find something you're passionate about by playing games. So it's not all the scaremongering of years gone by about do games make people violent and all this sort of stuff. That argument's pretty much been put to bed. Games don't make people violent.
Yeah, I guess that first shooter version of things. I mean, my son's in the army now, and I remember having conversations with him and talking to his friends, to, you know, about the amount of history and weaponry and unit tactics that they knew when they joined the army just through sort of gaming collectively. Yeah. Online, it wasn't all about learning to, you know, being the person that was doing the shooting, but more like participating in things.
Yeah, you really pick things up by playing these games. Like, you know, if you're playing something like Call of Duty, you understand which tactics to employ in certain, you know, environments and things like this. You know what equipment is useful and what's not by playing it. It isn't true to life one-to-one, but it's definitely a close approximation. So you're learning something by doing it. And now if you apply that to something other than a shooter game, and you have it as a role-playing one, and they're all about conversations and you know, practicing like an identity or being becoming someone new, then it's an opportunity for you to explore new aspects of your own personality in a safe space.
Now, Jason, I remember reading an article quite a few years ago talking about someone that was teaching the curriculum through music. So like kids were learning to sing and they were singing subjects like physics and stuff like that. And I remember at the time finding it quite amusing and then thinking it was probably bordering on genius that you got people involved. Now, if I think of it like that, but then I just think about how you explain people participating in gaming and an ecosystem, actually there is probably not a subject in the national curriculum at any level that couldn't in some way, shape or form engage you as someone that could create a game or get their students to engage a game that would actually enhance and make their learning enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that too sweeping a statement, or do you think that's probably quite good?
No, I do. I'm going to make an even bolder statement. Okay. I think that there is no job out there that draws from more industries, more skills than games. I think it is the most universal of roles. Like, if you have no coding backgrounds, you're not an artist, you're not any of that sort of stuff, you can bring something to games. Like earlier today, I was meeting with the Game Development Society from DMU and telling them a story about some early testing I was doing for a game. And one of the people from the studio told me that he had a theology degree and he's here making games. And I'm like, how do those things connect? But it's because the subject of the game was about you playing as if you were a god, like a real-time strategy game where you've got this overview of the world and the little people are there and you're telling them what to do. It was that kind of game, but you were controlling this giant animal creature. It was a game called Black and White back in the mid-2000s, very popular game back then. And the subject matter was, you are playing as a god. What does it mean for you to be a god? Are you going to be a good one or an evil one? How are you going to treat your people? And his background in theology really informed how they made that game, like the morality systems and how you interacted with the world. And I can't think of something so opposed as the study of, you know, culture, history, philosophy as theology and coding a commercial digital product. Those two things just feel on the opposite ends of the spectrum. But in this moment, at that time and place, they were brought together and it was an immensely popular game.
Brilliant. I love that. I remember when I was teaching here on the social media practice module, just after Rob, actually, teaching here at De Montfort University, I remember having a conversation with students about how a lot of the parents, I think the whole fire festival thing was going on at that time, a little bit of a Ponzi scheme type thing. And I just said to them, well, go home at Christmas and just say to your parents, I'm interested in working in marketing and PR and advertising. I said, because that's exactly what being an influencer is now. You are just putting yourself probably more in front of the product as a user, whereas before it was about marketing and PR executives would be selling a product, whereas you are actually demonstrating it. And they went home and it was interesting how the parents were like, oh, I've never thought of it like that, blah, blah. And I think we're at the same point, aren't we, with gaming and games development and gamification with lots of industries now, where it is a genuine, serious, money-making career.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, the industry has been going since the late 60s, really. So it's about 60 years old now as an industry. And you know, if you think that the film industry is just over 100 years old, games aren't that far behind. Yet if you told your parents you were going to become the next great director, they'd be like, excellent, here, I understand that, that's great. But if you say, I want to be a creative director at a game studio, it's met with, what's that? I don't understand.
But so how do you go about educating? If you were working with a group of students, how important is it that you give them the tools to be able to explain that to their parents? Because it's those people that you have to win round for. That's great, have a bit of fun, but now I want you to be a doctor.
Yeah. I mean, we do hear a lot of that games are, you know, misunderstood by generations beyond a certain point because they didn't grow up with them. They weren't, you know, it might have been this thing that you went to in the arcades, but it was never at home.
It was fun. It wasn't about a serious thing.
Yeah, and they see it as like going out and socializing, and it's this thing that connects people. But in reality, doing that online is the same thing now. Like, you're learning new skills just by learning to communicate over the internet or collaborate in ways that aren't verbal or, you know, physical expressions and stuff. It's in a virtual space. There's a lot of stuff that you can learn from this. So I think it's about reframing the way you talk about what games are in terms of a form of media or a related industry that the parents will connect with. Like, if you talk about it in the sense of making films, or you're going to a company to make financial software or something, they'll go, oh, you're working in fintech, you're big money there. You go, yeah, sure. So I can go and make some software over here that will sell 1 million units with this company and reach more people than this app that you've downloaded on your phone that you use every day. So I can self-publish through the App Store. I can sell my game to 1 million people. But if I go through the corporate grind and, you know, fight my way to the top of a, you know, fintech company, you know, I'm just a cog in a machine. And yeah, it just, there are similarities, but I think it's about kind of conveying that in a certain way.
So you're listening to John Costa with Rob Watson on the Spotlight on Arch Show. And this week we're joined by Jason Boomer. We've been talking about gaming and game development and events and curriculum subjects and stuff. So Rob, let me bring you in here. Are you someone that grew up, we're similar age, or you grew up with games and stuff? I never, so like, you know, this is all alien to me.
Yeah, I mean, I worked at Dixon's when I was 16, and I remember borrowing a Commodore 64 and bringing it home because you could take them overnight, and everybody else in my family were playing it, and I was like, I kind of didn't understand. But it was around that proto game. There was a company there that was kind of nearby that I got introduced to. And you think, if only I'd have kind of followed there up, but it was just alien to me. It was kind of something you thought of, you know, coming through from Japan or something. But the interesting thing is, I can't remember the name of the store, but there's a game store in Silver Arcade in Leicester. And talking about the experience of gaming culture. So if you go to the second floor, it's a cafe. And I thought it was like a gambling arcade, but it's not. It's a game store. And they've got a cafe in there, and you could buy magazines and retro games and figures and badges and things like that. There's a whole range of stuff. And then the atmosphere was just great. And it's like this meeting place for young people and their parents. And it was just this, you know, you're sitting there, you know, if you want to know. And I always say, games culture, according to volume of sales, is the most, is the highest entertainment media in the world. And yet, which radio station do you listen to that represents that game culture? So it hasn't translated into broader popular culture. It's still very segmented. So we don't understand and we don't appreciate what that has brought and what it's about and the music and the, you know, maybe a bit with Grand Theft Auto, because there's a radio player in the car, yeah. So that influences some music, but it hasn't spread into a kind of, where do you get your music from? Well, you get it from watching games, and that hasn't connected with people quite in the same way as I thought it might have done.
Can I give a cheeky shout out?
Yeah, go for it.
So
yeah.
The place you mentioned in the Silver Arcade is called Super Game Shack, and the level of the one on the second floor is called Super Game Shack Level 2. We were talking in earlier on about the events we used to run many, many years ago. The guy that runs that, a guy called Richard Tewksbury, he used to rent CRT TVs for people that wanted to run retro gaming events. And so we used to hire the CRT TVs from him that were stored in the basement of pub just on DMU campus. And yeah, he's given that up now, and he put all of that effort, that interest, that into setting up Super Game Shack. It's excellent place, and I highly recommend checking it out.
Well, there we go. We don't mind giving a name shout out to people that do good stuff. Richard Tewksbury, fantastic.
Find him on Instagram.
Yeah, follow him on Instagram, absolutely. So I'm going to ask you now a question, and we'll probably be interrupted by a short break, but as someone interested in the media, as Rob is as well, you know, if you want to start a fight in a room, you turn around and say to someone, photography is art. Fight on, you know, choose your weapons and go for it. I mean, so gaming, is gaming art?
Oh, come on, John. Come on.
Don't hit me. Don't hit me.
Yes. Yeah. Games are art. Games are art. Yeah. Even though it's a medium that you really couldn't exist without a coding, programming base, it is art. The programming itself is art. There is an art to programming in certain ways. There's different languages that games are made in. Languages are art. This is just a different form of language. So even if you think of the least, air quotes, artistic part of making a game, it is still a form of art. You know, we can't have this conversation now without mastering our own language. You couldn't build a game without mastering the language of the game. So yeah, I fundamentally believe in my core that games are art. And you know, when you look at things that are being done with the Unreal Engine, which is one of the games engines that one of the two big ones, that and Unity. The Unreal Engine is what Fortnite is made in. So very, very popular, huge, hugely popular engine. It is, at this point, indistinguishable from real life. When you see their tech demos, you don't know if you're looking at drone footage, you know, shooting through the desert or any of that sort of stuff. It is absolutely incredible. And it's even being used in TV shows like The Mandalorian, where all of the sets are made in Unreal. So you've got your actors and a big green screen, and the world they are acting in is made in Unreal. So yeah, it's absolutely art.
So Jason, let's talk a little bit about how you've got the game as the sort of the bed, if you like, and how it draws on other things. So things like photography and use of, say, film and things like that. How are they? I mean, as someone interested in documentaries, documentarian, I'm always like, you know, docudramas and things like that, where it's, you might not have necessarily film or photography evidence of those things look like that, but there's enough diaries, journals, descriptions, paintings of that stuff that you can do it. Do you think this is that point that we're at? You were talking about there, Mandalorian and things like AI, where we're really at this exciting edge of what the possibilities are, and we've not even covered that yet. We're not even there.
Yeah, I think you know, the fact that games are evolving as fast as they are means that there is just such a rich set of material that we can study, that we need to archive. A lot of this stuff has been lost because of the development practices of studios and the IP sort of protection of this stuff. They don't want to share the code and all that. So we're losing a lot of this material from the early days of game development. And I think that, you know, there's an increasing movement nowadays in games preservation. There are a number of museums and organizations in the US that are you know, kind of tackling this problem. And in Leicester, where we're based here, they've got the Retro Computing Museum just north of Leicester. I think it's in Syston. And they're only open on Sundays, but they've got this warehouse, this converted warehouse in Syston of all of these retro consoles, old VR machines. They've got magazine libraries and all this sort of stuff. They take donations of equipment that, if it's broken, they'll, you know, break it down and use it to repair machines. Any surplus, they'll sell that, and it's a charity, so it all goes to kind of keeping the place running. So yeah, that there is an increasing interest, but also an increasing need for games preservation and kind of archiving of this material. And I think that the only way we'll really drive more interest in that is if we start exhibiting some of this stuff to reflect on the histories that we have captured, so we can then say, well, these are the whole pieces that we've lost to time. Here's what you remember, and we can show you it, but this other thing that you know is just gone. And, you know, I think it's devastating to lose part of that digital heritage.
Yeah, and I think people forget about that as well. You know, whenever you talk to anybody in sort of, you know, archiving or museums and stuff like that, they said it's great. You know, someone goes, oh, I've got this like VHS tape of this historic moment, you know, Leicester or whatever. They give it to you and you turn around and go, well, you know, I've got three VCRs. One works, one's being repaired, and the other one I use for spares. And so with every innovation when it comes to the creation and the kind of memory storing of content, if you like, there's the thing that costs money isn't necessarily the storage of that, it's actually maintaining and keeping equipment that you can actually play that on. So everyone goes, oh, we've got a Super 8 film, do you want it? And of course you've got to have like one or two Super 8 machines that are at various stages of working on. So what you're talking about there really is almost something not people aren't thinking about it because they can watch it as a YouTube, someone playing it, and all that's great. They don't think about, well, if I had that game cassette, would I be able to put it into a Commodore that someone's still got? Because this stuff just gets older, and I suppose that's really where things like, you know, cameras being, you know, someone's got an Instamatic and they've repurposed it to take digital photos and stuff, but they're keeping the preservation there, but it's not the original. That must be quite a difficult thing when you put on an event like a CreatorCon. How much do you have something that people want to play that's modern, and then how much do you want to go retro in order to keep people hooked into that?
Yeah, that's the eternal struggle, really, is you know, do you want people to have the actual experience they had of what it was like back in the day, or do you want to simulate how they think they felt or how they did feel about it? So we don't know. Even people in the games industry themselves are kind of struggling to answer this, because one of the popular things that are happening nowadays is a lot of remasters of games. So they'll take an old game, they'll essentially rebuild it from the ground up and try to replicate what was there. But the technology's come on so much, the game controllers are of a different layout and all of this sort of thing, and people have experienced different types of games. So if you then say, here is exactly the old game that you remember, you'll start playing it and think, this isn't fun anymore, because I'm now used to things that are more polished, things that are smoother, things that are kind of more fleshed out. So there's this struggle of, do you fully and accurately represent what it was, or do you make subtle changes to it to bring it in line with what you expect, so you still get that sense of nostalgia, even though there are changes?
So, Jason, just to finish this off, what are you studying? Because I know you're doing a PhD at the moment. Is that related to a subject that's about, I'm assuming it's about gaming, but yeah, about more like the ecosystem and the development and stuff?
Yeah, so I'm a student at De Montfort University. I did my master's degree here a few years ago, and it was studying like streaming communities, so communities where people play games and other people watch, with a focus on what do people get out of doing that. Like, why do people watch other people play games? Why do people play games for other people to watch? What's the point, really, and what is the whole kind of experience?
Is that like Twitch? Is that like
exactly, kind of Twitch, like Twitch, yeah, Twitch, YouTube, things like that. So it was really trying to understand what do people get out of that whole process, and it came down to that. Playing games helps you learn something, but also watching games helps you learn as well. Not just learning from the person playing the game, but the person playing the game adds their commentary on top of it. So there's someone that's interpreting the game for you, and then adding their own commentary. So not only are you looking at, say, Minecraft, you're now watching someone else do something with Minecraft. They might do something different than you, so you're seeing other ways of exploring that game world. They're talking about it, they're giving you tips and advice and things, so you're learning from their experience. But because you're part of this community that watch these, you're in chat, so you're in the forums, you're in the live chat and things like this, so you're now talking to other people that are also watching it, so you're influencing one another. So you're doing this like community building as a part of watching this stream. So it's not just the stereotype of, you know, air quotes, nerds in the bedroom watching, you know, it's this isolating experience. It's not. You're a part of a community. You're tapping into something bigger than what's in your screen. You're tapping into the lives of all these other people that have been drawn to this content creator, and they're there servicing that audience, that community, by imparting their knowledge, their experience, and kind of, you know, facilitating this kind of bringing people together.
And your PhD, is that an extension of that now?
It is, yeah. So those communities, I think what I presented there is quite like an idealistic view of it. Like, it can only be good when these things happen, but they do often go wrong, and that's a really unfortunate thing. There was a major event called Gamergate that happened in the mid 2010s. And arguably still going on to this day, where there was a lot of harassment and discrimination taking place in online communities. So as I grew up watching online gaming, I was a part of that community. I wanted to understand, why did it go wrong? Why do certain people, it's not all of them, it's a very, very small fraction of people, but a very vocal minority as it is, can become hostile. They can abuse and discriminate and harass people. And I wanted to understand, how does it happen? why does it happen? Where does it happen? And what can we do to try and encourage people to be more inclusive and welcoming and friendly to one another online? And there is a fairly well-established connection between Gamergate and the Brexit vote and the Trump campaign to become president the first time around. And the working theory is that Gamergate was a testbed for a lot of the strategies used by right-wing politicians. So the idea of doing something offensive and then when you're called out on it, pulling back just enough to say, oh, it was a joke, it was a joke. You know, I've said something racist. Oh, no, you took it badly, I didn't mean that. But then if that happens enough, suddenly what people define as acceptable shifts towards the worst end of the spectrum. They're like, oh, okay, they're only joking, so it's fine. Now suddenly playing at the edge of what is and isn't racist or sexist or homophobic or transphobic, all of that becomes, quote, acceptable, when really it's not. But they're changing people's beliefs. They're changing what people will tolerate and pushing it to the worst end of the spectrum.
And like pushing the line all the time, constantly testing the barriers and stuff like that.
And if you look at, you know, Trump's campaign, I wasn't expecting to kind of pull off into the subject, but if you look at like Trump's campaign, a lot of what he set up on those podiums was inflammatory, was, you know, offensive, but the culture had been changed so much that people weren't just immediately put off by that. So there is a connection between the practices of Gamergate and what was being used in these campaigns.
Jason, thank you very much for talking to us today.
No, thank you.